Good morning. Welcome. We'll go ahead and get started. This is our seventh out of 10 lessons in ongoing series, The Gospel, Politics, and Culture. And for the next three lessons, we're going to be looking at now specific political issues that we're facing, and as we seek to form biblical convictions on these issues. And they're the same three issues that have been outlined in a document that was drawn up several years ago by some Christian leaders, Charles Colson, Timothy George, and Robert George, that's been signed by a number of leaders, both evangelical and Catholic, as well as others. It's called the Manhattan Declaration. And that document outlines the issues of human life, marriage, and religious liberty as the three most important political moral issues that are facing us today. So I thought it would be good for us to spend a few lessons talking about those three things. And so today we'll be focusing on the gospel and human life. Now my intention is actually not to talk about all the range of issues regarding human life in our culture today, though if you have a question about anything that's not directly relevant, that's fine. But I just want to focus today on the abortion issue. As I was going through and writing this out, I realized that just talking about that was going to be substantive enough and take up enough time that we wouldn't be profited by trying to address other things as well. So that will be the focus of today. Let's begin with the word of prayer. Father, we ask you to guide us this morning through your word in the formation of biblical conviction and with hearts that love truth and that will seek to bear witness to the truth for the sake of your glory in our nation. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. One of my favorite novels is Jack London's The Call of the Wild. It's a story about a dog named Buck who is kidnapped from his home in California, and he's sold up north into Canada to become a sled dog for the Klondike Gold Rush. And it's a story about how Buck learns to become really a different kind of animal as he hears the call of the wild and begins to live in a totally different setting. Well, early on in the story, Buck, as he is just getting into Yukon, Canada, he and another dog that was sold with him named Curly, there's a very vivid story that London tells about an early experience that is formative for Buck. And I want to read you a quote from the book. It says, Buck had never seen dogs fight as these wolfish creatures fought, and his first experience taught him an unforgettable lesson. It is true, it was a vicarious experience, else he would not have lived to profit by it. Curly was the victim. They were camped near the log store where she, in her friendly way, made advances to a husky dog the size of a full-grown wolf, though not half so large as she. There was no warning, only a leap in like a flash, a metallic clip of teeth, a leap out equally swift, and Curly's face was ripped open from eye to jaw. It was the wolf manner of fighting, to strike and leap away, but there was more to it than this. 30 or 40 huskies ran to the spot and surrounded the combatants in an intent and silent circle. Buck did not comprehend that silent intentness, nor the eager way with which they were licking their chops. Curly rushed her antagonist, who struck again and leaped aside. He met her next rush with his chest in a peculiar fashion that tumbled her off her feet. She never regained them. This was what the onlooking huskies had waited for. They closed in upon her, snarling and yelping, and she was buried, screaming with agony, beneath the bristling mass of bodies. So sudden was it and so unexpected that Buck was taken aback. He saw Spitz run out his scarlet tongue in a way he had of laughing, and he saw Francois, swinging an axe, spring into the mess of dogs. Three men with clubs were helping him to scatter them. It did not take long. 2 minutes from the time Curly went down, the last of her assailants were clubbed off. But she lay there limp and lifeless in the bloody, trampled snow, almost literally torn to pieces. The swart half-breed standing over her and cursing horribly. The scene often came back to Buck to trouble him in his sleep. So that was the way. No fair play. Once down, that was the end of you. Well, he would see to it that he never went down. This chapter is entitled The Law of Club and Fang. And it's an outline, so to speak, of the way of the wild, in which the only morality is that of strength. The strong are those who triumph, the weak are those who are destroyed, and thus might makes right. Whole societies have operated by this ethic. Think, for example, of Nazi Germany, where the stronger Aryan race oppressed and sought to destroy the weaker among them, most notably the Jews. This is what I would call a satanic ethic. Let me make sure I'm pushing the right button here. Maybe my battery's out. Could you guys do it from up there? Thank you. This is what I'd call a satanic ethic, which I'm going to contrast this morning with a gospel ethic. Hopefully it'll be up there soon. Russell Moore has said that the demonic elements of the universe wish for us to see ourselves as either more than we are or less than we are. In fact, I would argue that the only thing wrong with that quote is that he uses the word either. I would argue that it should actually be that the demonic elements of the universe wish for us to see ourselves both as more than we are and less than we are. That is, each one of us is to think of ourselves as our own God who determines reality for ourselves, but that in turn causes us to look at other human beings who get in our way as less than human. And thus, in a satanic ethic, the weak are obstacles to be overcome by the strong. But in a gospel ethic, what I'm calling a gospel ethic here, the weak must be defended and supported by the strong. And the reason for that is because in the biblical teaching, every human being, no matter how weak, is a potential king or queen of the universe. Every human being. By virtue of what we are, in C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia, we are daughters, sons of Adam, daughters of Eve, and there are thrones prepared for us. And thus, every human being, no matter how weak, is to be protected and supported as a human being. And it is in Jesus Christ that the strong became weak for the sake of the weak. He came for us who were weak, so that he might lift us up, and in imitating his love for the weak, we bear witness to his redemptive work. God's judgment one day will come through King Jesus, and it will one day answer the atrocity of the unrepentant murder of the weak. We believe by faith that that day is coming. But until it does, may we bear witness to the reign of King Jesus over us by fighting for the sake of the weak. And so this morning I want to look at two different points here, the biblical teaching on human life and then how that applies to the abortion debate. And so we begin with first, the biblical teaching on human life. Is this working now? I don't know if they're doing that or I'm doing that. I'll just leave it down because I don't think it's working. I'm good. I got it. Yeah, it's not working. Okay. So the biblical teaching on human life begins with an understanding of the Bible's teaching of what we are and therefore what follows as a result. So just three passages I wanted us to think about this morning. One is Exodus 20, verse 13. And that is in the list of the Ten Commandments. This would be the sixth one. You shall not murder. Every human society has recognized this principle. Even those, of course, that didn't have the Ten Commandments have recognized that murder is wrong and is not to be tolerated in a society. Now, there's a little caveat to that I'll need to add later. But that has been a universal human acknowledgement that murder is wrong. Now, why is that? When, as a society, not all of us, the majority of us, do not think that way about other forms of life. There are some who would, but the majority of Americans today and the majority of people in all countries, I would say, today, understand that there is a difference when it comes to killing a human being versus killing another form of life. We don't have a moral outcry regarding, for example, killing animals for food or killing them for other reasons, clothing or other supplies that we have. We regard human life as having a particular value that makes murder wrong. Now, what is that particular value? Well, this brings us to Genesis 1, 26 to 28. Genesis 1, 26 to 28. This is where God says, on the sixth day of creation, then God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. So the question here is, what does it mean that God created man in his own image? There's been a lot of debate over this throughout church history, and a lot of the debate has been focused on what is it that we possess that constitutes the image of God. And some theologians, philosophers have said, well, it's our capacity to reason that makes us the image of God. Others say it's our capacity to relate to God and to other human beings. Some might say it's our immortal spirit that makes us like God in this respect. But I would argue that all of these approaches are wrong. All those things might be included in what it means to be the image of God. But I think the biblical teaching is actually not that the image of God is something we have. It is what we are. We are made to be representatives of God. Every part of us, in some regard, represents God. Not only in our relating to him and to each other, but simply in the very constitution of our human nature. And thus that plays out then in the role that we have to rule over creation for him. So to be human is to represent God. That's a biblical teaching that I'm building off of here. Now, how does that inform then our evaluation of murder and why murder is wrong? For this, I'd encourage you to turn to Genesis 9. Genesis 9, look at verses 5 and 6. Now, this is a new situation. After Genesis 1, the creation of man, now we are at the point where man is being given a new start after the flood. Noah has now come off the ark. And the sad truth is that sin is still a live reality. Even though the world has been purged of much human rebellion, sin is still there in Noah and his descendants. And as a result, there has to be some kind of governing structure that will be there to protect human life from the threat of violence. And that's why God says in Genesis 9, 5 and 6, and for your lifeblood, I will require a reckoning. From every beast I will require it, and from man. From his fellow man I will require a reckoning for the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. Now here's why. For God made man in his own image. And so the argument of Genesis 9, 5, and 6 is that the death penalty is justified for the crime of murder because of the very high value that we are to place on human life. That is, the innocent life that was taken must be valued by a society that is therefore willing to apply the ultimate penalty in retaliation for taking innocent human life. In other words, it is because man is made in God's image that murder matters. Murder is ultimately about God. It is an assault on one who represents God. But it becomes acceptable in a society when certain categories of human beings, and that's always the weak as opposed to the strong, when certain categories of human beings are devalued. So again, remind you of Nazi Germany, for example. Or we could add other examples. Think of the killing fields of Cambodia. Think of the lynch mobs of the Jim Crow South. These are all examples of a society that failed to see the image of God in their neighbors. This is what happens when we do not see human beings for what they are. So then, how does this apply to the abortion debate? Well, first, let's start with some background. Background to the issue. It was in 1973 that the Supreme Court issued the Roe v. Wade decision. Now, this was a court case that had been brought before the court of a Texas law that put restrictions on abortion. And it was challenged, got all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court made a very creative, I would argue, and interesting ruling about the issue of abortion and how states could regulate it. Basically, the Roe v. Wade decision is what divided up pregnancies into three trimesters. And the court's reasoning was this. In the first trimester, a woman has a complete right to terminate her pregnancy for any reason whatsoever or for no reason. It's entirely up to her. The state can have no say whatsoever in the first trimester, which would be the first 13 weeks of pregnancy. Then in the second and third trimesters, the Supreme Court said that states could impose some regulations on the practice of abortion. However, there must be exceptions that would preserve the life and health of the mother. And what really made this a much more terrible decision, if you want to put it that way, and I do, is that there was a companion case that was actually ruled on the same day. And this was the Doe v. Bolton case, in which the health of the mother was defined so expansively that you could fit virtually anything under that category. So, for example, if a woman says, having this baby is going to put a financial, emotional strain on me and my loved ones, well, what pregnancy is not going to do that, right? So, but that's the argument, that health has to be defined so expansively that a woman and her doctor can decide that this situation constitutes an exception that the state can't regulate. So Frances Beckwith has put it this way, that the result of the Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Bolton decisions in 1973 is that in the first trimester, a woman can have an abortion for no reason, and in the second and third trimesters, she can have an abortion for any reason. So that we've ended up with abortion on demand for all 9 months of pregnancy, practically speaking. That is what the Supreme Court said, and the states cannot do anything to stop that, at least in our current legal structure. Since 1973, more than 55 million abortions have occurred. That's the population of South Africa. That's roughly the same as if you took every person who lives in California and added that to every person who lives in the state of New York. This is what we have done as a society. According to recent statistics, in 2012, in New York City, black women had 31,328 abortions, 24,758 live births. If you are a black child in the womb in New York City, you have a greater chance of being aborted than of being born. And don't think that the abortion industry doesn't realize that fact. The racist history of Margaret Sanger, founder of Planned Parenthood, is well known. And I would dare say the KKK could not do a better job than Planned Parenthood is doing right now, with government funds going to them to do this. This is the most significant moral and political issue that our generation faces. That's my honest opinion. This, of all issues, this is the most significant moral and political issue. So how do we think through what abortion actually is? Well, let's talk then about the moral status of an unborn child. The issue that we're facing here is not the question of whether or not a fetus is alive. Is it alive in there? Of course it is. Everybody agrees it's a life. Everybody agrees that it's a living entity that's interacting with its environment and metabolizing and growing and all these kind of things. It's clearly a living being. The issue is not even, is it human? Everybody, again, would agree. I remember several months ago, I saw Marco Rubio doing an interview with Chris Cuomo, and Cuomo was trying to press him on this issue of abortion, and he was saying something to the effect of you believe that the baby in the womb is a human life, but let's acknowledge that that's a faith commitment. That's not science. And Rubio's saying, well, of course it's science. What else would it be? A cat? And of course, he has a good point. I mean, everybody would agree that it's a human life inside the mother's womb. It's not something else that's in there. So the real question that has to do with the moral status of the unborn child is this. Does it have personhood? It is a human life, but does it have the status of a person who is worthy of legal protection? And this is where a philosophical discussion would have to ensue, and you have to decide what makes you a person. And of course, Dr. Seuss, I really like his philosophy. A person is a person, no matter how small. But there are disagreements among philosophers about what exactly it is that constitutes a person. And there are basically two different ways you might approach this question. There's an operational definition of personhood, but there's also what we might call a substantive definition of personhood. Now, an operational definition would mean personhood is defined by something that we can do. Our personhood is something that we attain through our development. And whether that be defined in terms of our ability to reason or our ability to communicate or one of those criteria, there are some philosophers who have said personhood is not something you have, it's something you grow into. And you develop it. And some have even argued that while an unborn child may not have it, even a newborn child may not have it. Some philosophers have actually said this. Peter Singer, an ethicist, has argued that infanticide is justified because a newborn baby is not a person yet. But some dolphins are, according to his reasoning. But this would be an operational definition. The problem with an operational definition is that nobody can agree on what exactly would constitute personhood in that definition. There's not a universal, clear understanding here. A substantive definition, on the other hand, would argue that personhood is simply part of what we are as human beings. That is, to be a human being is to be a person worthy of legal protection. And I believe that recent scientific discoveries in the human genome have helped us recognize this fact. Not that DNA constitutes a person, but DNA helps us recognize that a person exists. Now, the reason for that is, at the moment of conception, when the sperm and the egg join together, the chromosomes align, and from that moment on, that entity, whatever you want to call it, is going to have a DNA sequence that is unchanged throughout all phases of development. Of course, DNA, we understand, is the blueprint for which human life is built. So the very same DNA you have today sitting in this chair is the DNA that was formed through the alignment of chromosomes at the moment you were conceived. So if we're talking about what is it, the only logical moment to say it has gone from being something else to a human being is that moment of conception when the chromosomes align, when the DNA sequence is there showing that this is now a human being at the very earliest phase of development. So I would argue a substantive definition is the only one that we could reasonably apply. If you hold to an operational definition, not only do you run into problems that we can't all agree on what you should be able to do to be a person, but then you run into the problems of the fact that those who are severely mentally handicapped wouldn't meet the definition. Nor necessarily would someone in a coma meet the definition. Nor would someone who may be experiencing dementia meet the definition. And what kind of society do we become when we start ruling on who is and who is not a person based on what they can do? It is a frightening reality to confront that philosophy and its consequences. So I would argue scripturally there is some support for this understanding of personhood, and that's in Exodus 21, verses 22 to 25. If you want to turn there, just meditate on this passage for a minute. Exodus 21, this is in a section of three chapters, 21, 22, 23, where God is giving to Moses, that is, particular case law. He's already given the Ten Commandments, and now he's giving to Moses to deliver to the people specific situations where the principles of the Ten Commandments would apply in different ways. So the Ten Commandments are the more, what you'd call the moral principles to govern the society. These judgments, as they're called in Exodus 21 to 23, are now specific applications of those moral principles to different kinds of situations that might come up. And this is what we read in verse 22. When men strive together and hit a pregnant woman so that her children come out, but there is no harm, the one who hit her shall surely be fined, as the woman's husband shall impose on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. But if there is harm, then you shall pay life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. A number of commentators throughout history have read this passage and have understood it to mean this. If two men are fighting and there's a pregnant woman nearby, and so they're fighting quite recklessly, they're not taking account of their surroundings, and they run into this pregnant woman and hit her and causes her harm so that she delivers the child and the child is dead. It's a miscarriage. Then there is to be a fine imposed. But if there's harm, meaning harm to her personally, that's when the law of eye for eye and so forth applies. So that has been one argument. Now, I'll go ahead and put out in the right here at the beginning of this discussion. Even if this is the way you interpret this passage, it does not overturn what I've already said about the personhood of the unborn, because a fine is still assessed for what is here an unintentional crime. And that shows that this life is still to be valued, even if it's not raised to the level of murder. And it doesn't appear to be raised to the level of murder on that reading because it's unintentional. And so you have similar kinds of things in verses 12 to 14 where somebody strikes a man so that he dies. But if he didn't mean to, then he's got a place where he can flee. So there, that unintentional dynamic could be a part of this. But I don't believe this passage is actually referring to miscarriage. And here's why. There are Hebrew terms available that could have clearly specified miscarriage. None of those terms are used in this passage. One other issue is that the word harm, look again at verse 22, but there is no harm. There's no object specified there. It doesn't say there is no harm to the woman, and it doesn't say there is no harm to the baby. Now, why would it do that? I think it's telling us to read it as including both. That is, there's specified no object because the object of the harm could be either the woman or the unborn child. And so I think it is more likely that this passage is talking about premature birth, so that two men are fighting, they're not taking account of their surroundings. They hit a pregnant woman, causing her to give birth prematurely, but there's no harm. The baby's fine. The baby's okay. Everybody's okay. There still needs to be a fine in that situation. Why? There's no harm. Because these men were acting recklessly. They did not take account of their surroundings. They did not honor a pregnant woman and the child she was carrying, and that vulnerable child, through their actions. It'd be similar to a person getting pulled over for a DUI who hasn't had a wreck yet. We would still impose a penalty on him, even though no life was taken. So that appears to be what is going on here. There's a penalty imposed for being reckless around an unborn child because that child is vulnerable and that child's mother is vulnerable in this situation. However, if there is harm, either to the mother or to the child, which seems to be what is implied here, then there is to be eye for eye, life for life. That is, whatever harm is inflicted, there must be proportional justice applied. And so this text read this way actually elevates the status of a pregnant woman and her child to a status of special protection under the law. Because I'm not aware of any other law that would impose eye for eye for an unintentional crime, which would be an indication that God has a special concern to protect the offspring of his people. So I do believe that gives us biblical evidence for the personhood of the unborn. And so what often happens politically is that this discussion is not taking place over the issue of personhood. It's actually about the rights of the mother. And I believe in our political rhetoric today, we've seen an elevation of the rights of the mother in this discussion. Because there are many pro-choice advocates who have no answer to the question of when personhood begins. I remember then candidate Obama in 2008 when he was participating in a dialogue with Rick Warren and John McCain. Rick Warren asked him this question, asked both of them this question: when does a baby receive human rights? Candidate Obama's answer was, to answer that with any kind of specificity is above my pay grade. In other words, I don't know. I don't know when a baby gets human rights. If he really believed that, then he would say then the baby should be protected at all 9 months of pregnancy because we just don't know when it should have rights. But his position is actually the opposite. A baby should have no protection because we don't know. You see, if you're going to err, you should err on the side of not murdering. But that's not the philosophy that's followed by the left today. They focus on a woman's right to choose. They say, even if it is a person, a woman has a right to control what happens in her own body. Even if that baby inside her is a human being, a person, then it's her decision whether or not that child should have life in the end. Because that child is, if she doesn't want the child there, that child is an intruder. Just like you might have a right to shoot somebody who's broken into your house in the dark, an intruder who's posing a threat, so does a woman, it is argued, have a right to take the life of an intruder she does not want. But this consideration ignores two major ethical concerns. One is that what happens in a woman's womb is not merely a matter of concern to her, but also to God. Psalm 139, verses 13 and through 16. David writes, "For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them." This decision, if it is that, if you want to call it that, is not one a woman is to make autonomously. Is not one that she is to make without considering that this is God's work going on. So that's one major ethical consideration. It's not really her body in the end, it's God's. And then number two, no one has a right to assume a separation of sex from pregnancy and childbearing. No one has a right to assume that they are entitled to that. God made these things to go together. And thus, abortion is part of a culture that's seeking to separate what God has joined in the nature of human life. So, with these considerations in mind, what exactly is abortion? The nature of abortion is this: it is an act of murder. It is an assault on the image of God, an assault on the dignity of personhood. I do believe there are exceptions to this. There are rare exceptions, perhaps a tubal pregnancy, for example, where the chances of the child surviving are zero. So there are some considerations to bring in there, but I believe in the vast majority of circumstances, abortion is indeed an act of murder. It is an example of the strong oppressing the weak who cannot defend themselves. We are a society with blood on our hands. And that blood, like Abel's blood, called out from the ground to God for justice. The blood of these unborn children, 55 million of them, are crying out for justice in our day. So I want us to feel the weight of this sin. I want us to feel the weight of our context and the society in which we live and the utter moral atrocity of what this is. And I also want us to feel the weight of Christ's work on the cross and marvel and rejoice at the fact that there will be countless women in the kingdom who had abortions and repented. There will be countless of them. And they will have the opportunity, I believe, to hold those children, to embrace them, to love them, and to be with them forever. This is what the grace of our God can do. There will even be doctors, perhaps, who have done this, given their lives to this, but who repented, who woke up to the truth, and came to see that the blood of Christ is sufficient to bring forgiveness for even the greatest atrocities. This is what abortion is, but let's remember the gospel is a message of an all-sufficient Savior. And let's proclaim this hope. And let's proclaim it to sinners like us, sinners who have done the unimaginable. And then number five, let's think of our role in fighting to defend the unborn today. What should we do now as a church, as individual believers? Number one, I believe we must celebrate the gift of children. Our lives, those of us who are married and incapable of bearing children, our lives must not be driven by, ultimately, by considerations of convenience. That is, we should not imagine that children are burdens to avoid, but gifts to welcome. And in addition to this, Christians must be on the forefront of caring for the orphans of this world. We need to be fathers and mothers to the fatherless. Number two, support women in crisis. Support women in crisis. I love the work of pregnancy centers that have sprung up all over the country. One such pregnancy center right here in Jackson, Birth Choice, doing wonderful things, not only in helping to bring pregnant women who are in crisis to see that what they are carrying is a human being, but also in providing for that woman so that she can care for that child when the child is born. Also by preaching the gospel to these women and seeing some come to faith. The work of Birth Choice and other places is wonderful work that we should support. We do support in our church budget. And many of you I know have worked there or volunteer there and continue by all means that work. And then number three, make the issue matter politically. I decided a number of years ago that any politician who supports the Roe v. Wade framework of basically unrestricted right to abortion does not get my vote ever. That was a decision I made because I believed if that is your moral calculation, you do not have the character to be in public office. That was a personal conviction that I came to. And thus, this year, when I saw that the candidates for president were going to be Sauron and Saruman, so to speak, I got excited when I saw, oh, the libertarians are putting somebody up there, finally. Libertarians, this is your year. And then the libertarians put up Gary Johnson, and it was Charlie Brown missing the football. Gary Johnson, I looked into his record. I didn't know anything about him. I knew he'd been a governor, but looked into his personal webpage, saw where he stood on abortion, and I could discern from the language he used, he supported the Roe v. Wade framework. Very clearly he does, which is not typically, in my understanding, that's not typically what libertarians do. But that was the position he took, and from that moment on, I wrote him off. I don't care where he stands on anything else. I wrote him off. He could not receive my vote. If you're interested, I know I've given the Republicans a hard time this year, but if you're interested in knowing the party platforms on where the two main parties stand on this, I'm going to put some excerpts on the slides up here. The Republican Party platform and the Democrat Party platform are as different as night and day. Even with all the terrible things that we've seen Donald Trump say and do, his platform, at least his party's platform, remains very strong, perhaps stronger than it's ever been on the question of abortion. So here's a quote from it. "We assert the sanctity of human life and affirm that the unborn child has a fundamental right to life which cannot be infringed. We support a human life amendment to the Constitution and legislation to make clear that the 14th Amendment's protections apply to children before birth." That would settle the matter for all 50 states if it were in the Constitution. By contrast, the Democrat Party platform says, "Democrats are committed to protecting and advancing reproductive health, rights, and justice. We believe unequivocally, like the majority of Americans, that every woman should have access to quality reproductive health care services, including safe and legal abortion, regardless of where she lives, how much money she makes, or how she is insured. We believe that reproductive health is core to women's, men's, and young people's health and well-being. We will continue to stand up to Republican efforts to defund Planned Parenthood health centers, which provide critical health services to millions of people. We will continue to oppose and seek to overturn federal and state laws and policies that impede a woman's access to abortion, including by repealing the Hyde Amendment." Now, the Hyde Amendment, if you're not aware of that, it's a law in place, been in place for a long time now, that says no federal tax dollars can be used to fund abortions. That's been our policy. So at the very least, there has been, even though we've murdered 55 million children, at the very least, there has been the protection for those taxpayers who don't want to be a part of it. Our tax dollars are not used, so we're told, for abortions. The Democrat Party's official position is we need to repeal that so that tax dollars can be used to fund abortions. These platforms are as different as night and day. They are utterly diametrically opposed to one another in every single conceivable way that I can tell. Now, there is good news. I'm actually very optimistic about this issue. Gains are being made. Partial birth abortion was banned during the Bush presidency. Abortion rates have been declining in the last several years. And it looks like, based on surveys, that the younger generation, the millennials, is actually far more pro-life than the older generation. I believe this is a culture war we are winning, ultimately, in spite of our terrible legal policy right now. It is a culture war that we are winning, and it is one I believe we ultimately will win. Just as slavery had to be fought out for a long time until it came to a resolution, the slave trade is ended, ultimately the institution itself is ended. If we are in this for the long haul, I believe we will come to a point where future generations will look back on us today and say, "What in the world were they thinking?" Just as we look back on those generations that kidnapped and sold Africans into slavery and say, "What were they thinking?" It can happen. I believe it will happen. But we must continue to fight, we must continue to pray, we must continue to labor with hope that justice one day will come. Are there any comments or questions this morning? Yes. Platform. That's a tough question. The question is, would the Republican candidate affirm the platform? I don't know to what degree platforms actually inform what the candidates do. Perhaps they have a very strong influence, perhaps not. I'm not sure how much platforms actually matter when you get into governing. I do know this. Donald Trump has taken very pro-choice positions in the past. But everything that he has said in the last couple of years, maybe, since he started running for the Republican nomination, he has affirmed the pro-life stance. His reasoning for it is not as satisfying to me as working it out philosophically. You know, he basically says he knew a family that they were pregnant, and one parent didn't want to have the baby, wanted an abortion, the other one wanted to have the baby. And they ended up having the baby, and the baby was wonderful. And that was a story that convinced him. Well, that's great. I mean, I appreciate that story. But what if the baby had not been wonderful? What if he'd been handicapped? Are you saying it would have been okay to abort it? I'd just like to press him on that. So how does he actually think about human life at this point? But at least publicly, he is proclaiming a pro-life policy position, as far as I can tell. Yes. That's right, yeah. Yeah, that's in the past he has made very strong pro-choice statements, arguments. So this is where you have to decide, I guess, do we trust him now? And that's a question that it's hard to answer. And that's where you have to pray and seek the Lord's wisdom, I think. Yes, Caitlin? Right, yeah. So does the party still stand by its platform with its current nominee? It's hard to know, and here we're getting into the weeds, I guess, of how politics works, but it's hard for me to even know what is the party doing with Donald Trump at all. Like, I don't know that the party power brokers even know what to do with him, it appears. So, you know, a lot of them are just keeping their distance. A lot of them are not even endorsing. So it seems that there's really two things going on in the Republican Party right now. There's the party, and then there's the Trump movement, and they're not totally synced up yet, as far as I can tell. Was there over? Yeah, Ryan? Yeah. Has there been a movement, an actual movement for a constitutional amendment? I'm not aware of one. There may be. I'm not aware. But I do know, you know, a lot of times people say, well, I vote, no matter who I vote for, nothing ever changes. That's actually not true. Because President George W. Bush signed into law a partial birth abortion ban. I believe it was 2006. And that was a bill that had been vetoed twice during the Clinton years. So, and of course, remember, President Bush also had the opportunity to appoint two Supreme Court justices. And I believe both of them that he appointed are men. I don't know this for sure, but I think both of them are men who would vote to overturn Roe versus Wade if that question came before them. So there are gains that have been made. It does matter. The way you vote actually does matter. For this, it's just the gains are often very incremental, and they just take a long time. Well, if you have further questions or comments about this, please feel free to talk to me afterward. Next week, we'll be looking at the gospel, marriage, and sexuality, the other major political issue that we're looking at today. So thank you for your time. You're dismissed.